the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, which have different interests with respect to Sudan. What they have in common, as the war has expanded, has been a real concern about the expansion of the war with respect to their own strategic interests, particularly with respect to the Red Sea area, and also issues of terrorism and militancy that is of a great concern to Saudi Arabia, but also United Arab Emirates. So this is an attempt on the part of not only the United States, but of course these countries to come together and iron out their differences with respect to Sudan itself. And they set out a proposal that has a number of points, but the most essential ones is to first and foremost understand that there's no military solution to the conflict, to have a truce that lasts for about 3 months, and then transition the country once again, or renew efforts at a transition to a civilian democracy. At least that is on paper. The problem has been, of course, is, as you can understand, the Sudan Armed Forces believes and has said that these are essentially talking points of the United Arab Emirates, and they've rejected them. On the other hand, the Rapid Support Forces, for legitimacy reasons, has said that they will abide by a truce, absolutely. They'll abide by a truce, but as we just discussed, they continue to implement these horrible human rights violations on the ground. The last point I want to make is the problem the Quad is that it excludes Sudanese civilian organizations and reaffirms the legitimacy, so to speak, of these two warring factions.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but pick it up another day. Professor Khaled Mustafa Medeni, thank you so much for joining us.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Radio. Today, December 18th, Oregon's Farm Worker Union PICUN and the Oregon for All Coalition have called a general strike in honor of the Day Without an Immigrant. This comes after months of increased and often violent immigration arrests across the state. These groups are asking people to stay home from work, to stay home from school, and to refrain from spending any money. As such, KBOO will not be fundraising today. Instead, we'll be focusing our programming on immigrants' rights in Oregon and across the country.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, another deluge of rain and flooding in the Pacific Northwest, a report card from the Secretary of State on how Oregon did with Measure 110, and Oregonians speak out on the rights of people taken by ICE. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 18th, 2025. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. One more time, an atmospheric river brings heavy rain to Portland and the entire Pacific Northwest. It comes as many people, especially in Washington State, are already struggling with the impacts of one atmospheric river. Now, yet another set to bring in several more inches of rain. The National Weather Service in Portland says in Oregon, the central Willamette Valley and the coast have the greatest chance of 2 inches of rain or more between now and Friday. And Washington Governor Bob Ferguson calls the flooding in his state historic.
It's been a difficult week, and that difficult week has been made more difficult by a loss of life that was reported in Snohomish County. On behalf of the people of the state of Washington, we extend our condolences to that man's family and loved ones for what's obviously a very challenging time. That is, we believe, the first fatality as a result of the storm. We've had many conversations about, in the last 5 days, how thankful we are that there had not been a fatality, and that really feeling like a minor miracle, to be perfectly honest, just given the scale of the challenge. But our hearts go out to that individual and their family and loved ones. I also want to express my deep appreciation to our first responders, the National Guard, our emergency management teams, numerous state employees, and all those who are lending a hand to help Washingtonians through this emergency. Long hours, as you might imagine, are the norm for those individuals. We deeply appreciate their hard work and dedication. I've met a number of folks who are not only doing that work, but then going to their homes at the end of a long day to try and stabilize their home situation and deal with the family situation because the floods are impacting them quite directly. And that is quite inspiring to see that level of dedication, even though they have their own risks that are personal, that they're out there doing their work to help other Washingtonians. The situation is extremely unpredictable. And that's something I want to emphasize again to all Washingtonians. We've seen that unpredictability just as two examples, the levee breach in Tukwila and also the situation in Pacific Washington where there is an emergency evacuation. I've seen video of people literally on the streets in the middle of the night coming out of their homes. It's not a 1 or 2 day event, right? We're in for the long haul, and all that water is putting a lot of stress on our infrastructure. And we're seeing that in real time. And that is something I just want to emphasize to Washingtonians to be alert. If you get an evacuation order, for God's sakes, follow it. I was down in Pacific County with Executive Mello Sunday, I think it was, and met with water rescue personnel. And one of those individuals said, and this is someone who's done a lot of water rescue in his professional life. He mentioned in the last couple of days being in a situation in the water that he felt was a life-threatening situation for him. Nobody wants to put our first responders in that level of danger. If you get an evacuation order, leave. That's for your own safety. It is also for the safety of first responders. Because guess what? If you're in trouble and you call, they will go get you out. But that puts themselves at risk. And so we're asking individuals for this very volatile situation to make sure that they're listening to those orders. I also just want to also add the coordination at all levels of government with tribes, with organizations from communities across our state has truly been tremendous. That is, I ask at every stop I go to, and I've been to a number, is there anything else you need? Is there any more coordination you need? The response has always been, no, we've got the resources we need. People are responding quickly. That's from Grays Harbor to Yakima, Stehekin, all around. That has been the response I'm hearing from folks. And that coordination, we need it. And it has served us well. It's helped. The other thing I think has helped is significant investments in infrastructure in recent years. In Ording, for example, investments in a levee system there compared to floods several years ago, night and day in terms of the impacts there. Mount Vernon, Washington, the seawall there literally saved the downtown. King County. The King County Flood Control District has invested hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to shore up our flood system here and prepare for it. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with individuals saying, it's bad, it's really bad, but the magnitude would have been far worse had we not made those investments. And these are investments just in the last recent years, have literally there commenced save lives, save businesses, saved entire downtowns. So I think all those things have served us well, and I'm grateful for leaders over recent years who have made those investments and the individuals in the state of Washington willing to invest in that. While it will be some time before we know the full scope of the emotional, physical, and financial impact, this natural disaster is undoubtedly one of the most devastating in our state's history. I do want to take a moment to speak directly to Washingtonians who are directly impacted by this emergency. We see you. We know the situation you're in. We're doing everything we can and moving heaven and earth to get resources to you as quickly as humanly possible. All Washingtonians, even those not directly impacted by this disaster, need to brace themselves. We are in for the long haul with this natural disaster. We'll provide more information, but our infrastructure has been compromised. We'll have to dig ourselves out of this situation. This is not a days-long thing or a weeks-long thing. This will be going on for months. This is a very significant event in the history of our state, and that's an understatement. And that's why we're working as hard as we can around the clock to treat it exactly that way. To give you a sense, we've already had over 1,200 rescues and evacuations across more than 10 counties in Washington state. We need to stay alert to the situation and obey road closure signs and evacuation orders. We expect additional widespread flooding across the state.
The state of Oregon has not done a particularly good job of implementing ballot measure 110. That's according to a new audit by the Secretary of State's office. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
Report 2025-29, an audit of the Oregon Health Authority's implementation of ballot measure 110, the state's landmark drug decriminalization law, says the measure lacks, quote, stability, coordination, and clear results. The audit, coming from the Secretary of State's office, says we have dedicated some $800 million in cannabis tax dollars and other funding to programs established by the measure, but it is unclear how many people have received services or how much those programs have actually helped Oregonians with substance use disorders.
One reason is that Measure 110 has been heavily revised over the past 5 years after being passed in 2020. Voters passed the measure aiming to connect drug users to treatment and recovery services, including housing assistance, instead of serving time in jail for possessing small amounts of drugs. Following adoption, it was repeatedly amended by the state legislature, and in 2024, it recriminalized possession of small amounts of illicit drugs. That was one of the more controversial parts of the measure. The new law also allowed for drug users to be deflected away from the criminal justice system and into treatment. The audit is the last of three required by the legislature. Not all of its findings are new. It reported that services funded through Measure 110 are isolated from other programs paid for by the state and the rest of Oregon's behavioral health system. It also found weak governance and frequent restructuring at the health authority, contributing to what was called a chaotic rollout of the program. Auditors stated, quote, "This resulted in a lopsided implementation where law enforcement had few tools to engage with people possessing small amounts of drugs and no established treatment system to support people who needed help. As a result, there were fewer interventions for people suffering from addiction and using drugs in public spaces," end quote. Auditors also found that gaps in data have limited the state's ability to evaluate whether Measure 110's ongoing spending on services is achieving goals that are spelled out in the law. For example, the OHA does not have baseline data from before Measure 110's passage to determine if it increased the number of treatment providers and services. The auditors made 6 recommendations. The OHA agreed with 3 of them and disputed at least parts of the others. One disagreement between the agency and auditors is over a recommendation that the OHA complete a baseline analysis to attempt to answer questions about how effective the law has been. That analysis would include whether overdose rates have declined since the law passed, as well as whether the number of services, providers, and people getting treatment for substance use has increased. OHA says the legislature has waived the requirement that it attempt to evaluate whether Measure 110 had any impact on overdoses. It added the rollout of the law coincided with the arrival of fentanyl in Oregon, making it impossible to make any valid comparisons. OHA said it is implementing 2 new data systems that will integrate with electronic health records and collect more complete data. All Measure 110 grantees will be required to submit their data through those systems by November 2026. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
And also in the state of Oregon, there's a bipartisan pitch for personal data protection in the age of artificial intelligence. Isabel Charlet has that story.
As the multi-billion dollar market for personal data expands, so are concerns about protecting everything from search histories to social security numbers. In response, Oregon is positioning itself as a leader in safeguarding its residents' sensitive information. The nonprofit Oregon Consumer Justice recently convened a panel of experts to discuss the issue and potential solutions. Representative Willie Chotzen of Portland says his initial interest in data privacy was around safeguarding reproductive healthcare patients and immigrants, but he discovered data privacy is a surprisingly bipartisan issue.
There are so many other reasons why people can care about data privacy. I think it's a really incredible opportunity where we can deliver wins that matter to each of us for our own values, but really reach across the aisle in terms of the values that they speak to.
Panelists said Oregon is on the forefront of data privacy legislation. The state passed the Oregon Consumer Privacy Act in 2023, which gives residents rights over their personal data. Another bill restricting the sale of geolocation data and other data related to minors will take effect in January. Dr. Katie Blevins of the Oregon Department of Justice says anyone can request that individual companies delete their information. She says under the Oregon Consumer Privacy Act, residents can file complaints with the DOJ if their requests are not honored or other privacy violations occur. Since the new law came into effect last year, she says the state has received nearly 300 consumer complaints, a much higher number compared to other states.
People may not care as much if their local grocery store has some data about them, but they probably care more if a lot of data brokers have data about them.
Buying and selling data is a multi-billion dollar industry. And Sean Patrick of PDX Privacy explains that with the progression of AI, more information is now being stored about regular citizens, including location, facial recognition data, spending patterns, and other personal details. He encourages everyone to take action to protect their personal data.
When we protect our information, we automatically begin to protect activists, we protect protesters, we protect immigrant communities, we protect a huge host of people that don't appear to be connected to us.
Research shows 86% of the U.S. general population believe data privacy is a growing concern, and the majority do not know what companies are doing with their data. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Oregon senior U.S. Senator Ron Wyden is celebrating the passage of his bipartisan legislation through the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee that would increase funding and resources for prescribed fires during colder, wetter months to reduce wildfire risk during the hotter, drier months of the fire season.
The prescribed fire tool is particularly important because it's underused now, and it's an incredible opportunity to do the preventive work that we know is so important. All through the West, it gets hot and dry. I'm not going to give a speech about why. The reality is we all agree it's hot and dry. You have a lightning strike in our part of the world. You have a fire. All of a sudden, you got an inferno on your hands. And all over my state, people are hungry, and they don't see this as a blue issue or a red issue. They just want to get out there and do the work. I think this is really the wave of the future. When we dealt with fire borrowing, we dealt with secure rural schools, we dealt with a whole host of measures that we just thought were useful tools. I think prescribed fire is going to be enormously important. And just a 10-second anecdote from home, we have a business summit in Oregon every fall, and people asked about what was going to be talked about. And when I mentioned just in the opening the discussion that I was going to talk about prescribed fire, that was the biggest applause of the day from every nook and cranny of the state, because they said, those guys on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee are really up to some good stuff. I think this is going to be one that's going to make a big difference. And I want my colleague to know we'll work very closely on the challenge of finding the dollars.
And Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter took on some of the top challenges in our region in her town hall with Oregonians this week.
I am a mom, a physician, and a very proud U.S. representative for Oregon's 3rd Congressional District. Thank you for joining us for my final town hall of 2025. It's been a whirlwind year, to say the least. It's truly the honor of a lifetime to represent you through this challenging time. Since coming into office in January, I've kept your voices at the center of everything I do. This is my 30th town hall. I responded to more than 140,000 messages, helped over 700 constituents navigate federal agencies, and returned more than $1 million directly to the people of this district. And as none of that happens without an amazing team, so I am grateful to them. And still, I know this year has also brought profound uncertainty and fear for many of you. Donald Trump returned to power with chaos and cruelty as his governing strategy. He's weaponized the federal government against immigrants and vulnerable communities. He's defied the Constitution, launched unauthorized military attacks, and is enriching himself while everyday Americans struggle to afford health care and food. These are not normal times, and they demand clarity, courage, and compassion. I know how easy it is to feel hopeless in the face of all of this, and yet I fervently believe in us, because I have seen the resilience of people through the hardest times in their lives. I have sat with patients and families for 20 years through challenging, devastating, unexpected moments, and what I've witnessed has affirmed my faith in our shared humanity, our commitment to community, and our ability to come through the hardest challenges imaginable, stronger, and more united. As many of you, I grew up in a working class family. I left home at 17 and was first in my family to graduate college, let alone medical school. And it was because of strong public schools, a union job, affordable higher ed, that I could chart a new path. And that is the promise of this country. And that promise is slipping away. Too many people today are working harder than ever and falling further behind. And it's not because they've done anything wrong. It's because the system has been rigged against them by the wealthy and well-connected. And that's why nights like this matter. When we come together to share our stories, to ask hard questions, and to dream bigger about what's possible. I'm in Congress to fight for what matters to you. Affordable health care, safe communities, climate action, housing affordability, reproductive freedom, and an economy that actually works for working families.
We have Diana.
Shortly before Thanksgiving, our friend, who we got to know because he has been doing landscaping work for us for well over a year, who's the kindest, gentlest person, who has no criminal record, who has no history of violence, and who I feel completely safe having in my home, which as a person who's recovering from trauma relating to men, me feeling comfortable about a man in my property and in my space says an enormous amount about how gentle and safe this person is. He was kidnapped by ICE shortly before Thanksgiving, and he is still being held at a detention center in Tacoma. I went with the family as a support person to his bond hearing, and while his bond was not approved, he is currently being encouraged to proceed with asylum paperwork. But these folks in these systems are largely invisible unless we make it so that people pay attention. And I am extending a direct request to you to help my friend, who is a business owner, who pays his taxes, who is a community member, and who is unjustly kidnapped, who is being held hostage by ICE. I refuse to use the word detained. I refuse to use the word in detention. He was kidnapped and he is being held hostage. And I was sitting there in his bond hearing as his wife shook and cried and wept, and as his brother tried to hold it together when he spoke to him in visitation, and none of this is right. So I am asking you, what can I do? How can I work with the family to work on a plan for helping this man to get back to the only community he has ever known in the United States, where he is contributing more than most taxpaying Americans who were born here?
Anna, and first, I absolutely can hear not just the passion in your voice, but the distress. And I am so sorry that he is going through this. And this is happening is across our community. We know that there is increased ICE activity in Portland and in Oregon writ large. So the first thing I want all our listeners to hear is, and I am going to address your direct question and request, but if you see ICE in your neighborhood and you see it with your own eyes, please report to the PERC hotline. It's 1-888-622-1510. And PERC is extremely practiced at getting information and mobilizing volunteers. Now, for people who've been detained, like your friend, your colleague, who need assistance with their case, we absolutely can help. We have our caseworkers and our team at large are very connected to not just how we personally can help. And I have gone, as many people know, to the Northwest Detention Facility, to the Border Protection Facility up in Customs and Border Protection up in Ferndale, and we went to El Salvador. So we are willing to do whatever we can.
The state of Washington has become a national leader in expanding apprenticeship opportunities. Isabel Charlotte explains.
The number of apprentices nationally and in Washington state has increased more than 70% in the past decade, according to a new report from the Washington Student Achievement Council. Washington currently has close to 16,000 active apprentices who are paid to work while they receive classroom instruction. Rachel McAloon is with the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries. She says over the past decade, significant state and federal grant funding has helped expand registered apprenticeships.
Instead of taking on a bunch of debt and going to college and still having to figure out where you're going to work when you graduate, we provide the job and full-time employment and benefits at the beginning of the program and then skill the worker up.
McAloon says about 80% of apprenticeship programs in the state are in the building and construction trades. But she adds Washington has been a leader in expanding into non-traditional industries like IT, healthcare, education, and cosmetology. McAloon says apprenticeships are growing as parents and counselors recognize their value and encourage young people in that direction. Employers are also seeing the benefits, gaining well-trained, safer, and more loyal employees.
They're also tailored to their individual employer and their business. So they get this great employee that also gets all of this background classroom instruction to really make them capable on the job.
The average income of apprentices who complete their program is over $100,000. But expanding apprenticeships involves more than creating new programs, Magaloon explains. It also requires a societal shift to view them as a strong alternative to traditional college education. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
House Democrats gained support for forcing a vote on extending the Affordable Care Act subsidies. That story and more impacting our democracy in today's edition of 2025 Talks.
We are now at 218. What that means is that it sets in place a process that will allow us to vote on a clean extension. And we have 218 people who will vote for it, which means we will pass it.
Massachusetts Democratic Representative Jim McGovern is backing a discharge petition, which now has enough signatures to force a vote next month on a clean 3-year extension of expiring Affordable Care Act subsidies. Should the extension pass in the House, it's probably dead on arrival in the Senate, where similar legislation just failed. House Republicans passed a health care plan without an extension, which faces an equally dim future in the upper chamber. With coverage for millions of Americans at risk, the cost of insurance continues to animate fierce politics, as it has since the end of the shutdown. But working families also face deep cuts to Medicaid from the Republican budget mega bill. Sam Burgess with the New Hampshire nonprofit New Futures says they and their peers in other states expect more than 10 million people to be kicked off government health care or priced out of coverage in the next decade. He says it's going to be part of the ongoing affordability crisis.
This is going to force families to choose between putting food on the table, paying rent, and then when you add in the premium, it adds a further strain.
A new NPR poll says slightly more than a third of Americans approve of the job President Donald Trump is doing on the economy. With unemployment and inflation both creeping up, Trump used an unusual primetime televised address to say his trade and budget policies will help nervous consumers and workers, but he made inaccurate claims about prices.
When I took office, inflation was the worst in 48 years, and some would say in the history of our country, which caused prices to be higher than ever before, making life unaffordable for millions and millions of Americans.
The president's handling of the economy will be key to how next year's midterms go, and his eroding polls may help explain why House Republicans are starting to rebel, with members signing 2 discharge petitions opposed by their leadership. And the Senate has approved a National Defense Authorization Act with a provision requiring the Pentagon to release more information about airstrikes on alleged drug boats from Venezuela. Republicans in the chamber did block a Democratic move to force the release of the full video of a September airstrike where 2 survivors were killed while clinging to burning wreckage. Oklahoma Republican Mark Wayne Mullen calls it raw partisanship.
This is all about politics. That's what this is about. Why are we protecting the ones that are poisoning our streets? Shouldn't we be trying to protect the ones that are on our streets?
Senators on both sides of the aisle want to see the unedited video or have it released. However, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says only a handful will get to. Tension ran high as FCC Chairman Brendan Carr testified before the Senate Commerce Committee, his first oversight hearing since publicly pressuring Disney to fire late-night comic Jimmy Kimmel for comments about the death of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Texas Republican Ted Cruz agrees with Carr that Kimmel's comments were tasteless, but says censoring them is a serious mistake.
What government cannot do is force private entities to take actions the government cannot take directly. Government officials threatening adverse consequences for disfavored content is an unconstitutional coercion that chills protected speech.
I'm Edwin JVR for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A Lumbee watch party celebrates the Senate passage of a recognition bill. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The Lumbee tribe is celebrating the passage of the National Defense Authorization Act, which includes legislation to grant the tribe federal recognition. The Senate passed the defense bill Wednesday as Lumbee citizens gathered in Pembroke, North Carolina for a watch party. Chairman John Lowry was in Washington for the vote and shared a short video message saying he's the last Lumbee chairman to go to D.C. to fight for full federal recognition.
Now our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren can come up here working and fighting and promoting other things for our people.
The tribe has sought federal status for more than a century. The effort has faced opposition, including by the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians in North Carolina, while President Donald Trump promised the Lumbee tribe federal recognition. This December marked the 84th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor bombing, a shocking attack that drew the U.S. into World War II and unleashed a wave of anti-Japanese hysteria. While the U.S. would join a global fight against fascism and Nazi concentration camps, it was erecting camps of its own at home, forcing tens of thousands of Japanese Americans into internment. 2 of those camps were set up on tribal lands in Arizona. In the first of a 5-part series, KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio examines the law that has given presidents power to imprison perceived enemies.
Mm-hmm.
December 7th, 1941. No American will ever forget this Sunday morning in Hawaii.
It all began with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. More than 2,400 souls were lost at the naval base on the island of Oahu. The U.S. was suddenly swept into the Pacific theater.
And we're going to fight it with everything we've got.
During FDR's Day of Infamy speech, he invoked the Alien Enemies Act. It's a 1798 wartime law authorizing the president to legally detain and deport anyone suspected of engaging in acts like espionage and sabotage.
Not only must the shame of Japanese treachery be wiped out, but the forces of international brutality, wherever they exist, must be absolutely and finally broken.
Weeks later, Roosevelt directed the Secretary of War to herd more than 120,000 people with Japanese ancestry into camps in Arizona, California, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, Idaho, and as far east as Arkansas. Two-thirds of prisoners were American-born citizens. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt had empathized with them, even touring a camp south of Phoenix in 1943. Barbara Perry says Eleanor was simply ahead of her time.
And certainly on how she viewed Japanese Americans, but she couldn't convince her husband of that.
Perry is co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Program at the University of Virginia. She also points out precedent was set a century prior, when President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act in 1830, marching tribes west of the Mississippi River.
America was pretty discriminatory.
Despite not being at war, President Trump reinvoked the Alien Enemies Act on day one of his second term.
To eliminate the presence of all foreign gangs and criminal networks, bringing devastating crime to U.S. soil, including our cities and inner cities.
This proclamation wasn't surprising to John Woolley, co-director of the American Presidency Project at UC Santa Barbara.
This is a domestic political rallying point that is very powerful with Donald Trump's base.
I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 18th,